It's called The Cross in the Closet. It's available at Barnes & Noble and Amazon, all the different Correct. Major retailers. All
right.
Okay. Well, I was raised in the Bible Belt in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm actually here right now visiting. But I was raised in the Independent Baptist Church movement. So Independent Baptist churches, the pastors and the teachers I had in school growing up were all graduates of Pensacola Christian College or Jones University, who, if I remember correctly, Bob Jones didn't allow even interracial dating until 2001. I could be mistaken, but I think that theologically, absolutely, that's the exact camp I came out of.
Okay.
No, my mom was raised, I think, Methodist, but my dad, but it wasn't, it really didn't take hold in her life until she was in her early 20s. My dad was raised Catholic, and he was a drummer in a rock group and stuff, and got away from faith. I think it has to do with the fact that they both had pretty wild teenage years and early college years, and so they felt this sense. There's this idea in the conservative church that we have to really modify our behavior in order to be acceptable in the eyes of God, and so my dad basically just went from one extreme to the other, and so in the process we got involved in, you know, ever since I was, you know, a little baby, in these just really hyper conservative Christian churches here in the South. I've got one older brother who's about 3.5 years older than me. My brother was always the dutiful, you know, first child, and I was always the more extreme kind of extroverted second child. And the thing is, you know, conservative theology is conservative theology. I know many, many conservative Christians, evangelical Christians, that just because of their conservative theology would never act out in their faith the way that I did with mine. I was just kind of a recipe for disaster, and looking back, I was going to end up being a Mark Driscoll or a Pat Robertson.
So what did you do? Try to think back.
I think when I was a teenager, it really hit home when I was a teenager.
I was
counselor, so to speak, to all my friends, and I would try to keep them on the straight and narrow, and they were teenagers that, you know, did typical teenage things, and I was the one that would kind of sit there and berate them for hours on the phone, and I got this kind of sense of empowerment from that. It was, you know, like I said, I just feel like I was a recipe for disaster, because when you combine this idea that I was absolutely right in everything I believed, and anybody who believed anything differently from me was absolutely wrong, and that it gave me this sense of pride, this hubris, that it was my job to kind of police the world.
How did you
and
go out? I mean, you must have been in trouble.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, I was still a nice guy, you know, especially to the people that agreed with me, but that's the thing. We were taught to hang around and spend time with the people that agreed with us, and we avoided the people that didn't.
Now, you were homeschooled? I mean, you weren't...
Until the seventh grade, I was homeschooled.
Okay.
Yeah. I went to a tutorial school here in Franklin, in Tennessee, called Franklin Classical School, which, ironically enough, yesterday I was on my flight from Atlanta to Nashville, and my old teacher was on there, and he's just an incredible man. I love him to death. The school that I went to that really personified this idea of absolute truth and this fundamentalist Christianity, that was the school I went to sophomore through senior year of high school, called Pioneer Christian Academy. And I graduated in a class of 10, three guys, seven girls, and we weren't allowed to have prom because dancing led to sex, and we couldn't have our sideburns down below the middle of our, you know, the hole in our ear, and we had to wear belts and no shirts with slogans, and just really super strict school.
But here's what I guess I'm trying to understand. Most kids, I think,
Yeah, because in the conservative Christian model and with who I was personality-wise, I got this sense of empowerment, and I'm better than my peers for acting, quote-unquote, more righteously, you know, for being that dutiful conservative Christian. I was, that's where I kind of sought, that's where I got most of my identity from.
And presumably and your so, parents and your church and everyone around you supported you.
Oh, absolutely. And then, you know, I taught VB at Vacation Bible School, and it was a volunteer youth pastor, and then I worked as a college coordinator, which is basically essentially a college pastor at a non-denom church here in Nashville. At one point, so absolutely. I think it started when I was 6 or 7 years old, when we first were taught about Sodom and Gomorrah and how two cities were destroyed because of the abomination of homosexuality, and that was my first real taste of it. And then going further, we were taught there are 6 passages in the Bible that I was taught were dealing with homosexuality. In hindsight, after having done some biblical study myself, realized that they don't. But
that people there was
this disconnect between the Old Testament and the New Testament, and the way that they explained it was that there was moral law and procedural law, and moral law was easily discernible. So not wearing clothes of mixed fibers or eating shellfish was procedural law, and homosexuality being an abomination was moral law. So there was no, they were taking and deciding for themselves what they believed to be abominable, you know, and without any kind of real basis for it scripturally. So, you know, not only that, but I was
quick side note, my favorite moral law.
Yeah.
It's right
there. I wish they would do that now, man. I could use some of that. I was just going to say that, but beyond the Bible stuff, the real hardcore teachings of the hyper-conservative fundamentalist church is the stereotypes that they teach you about LGBT culture.
Okay.
So I was taught that that homosexuals were... that every homosexual that I could encounter was going to be very liberal, very sexually promiscuous, have some kind of history of abuse, of sexual abuse or traumatic experiences from their youth. A lot of them would be, you know, pedophiles because they were sexually lascivious. They couldn't have a loving relationship. It was all about sex, 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 sex. And you know, that should have triggered some kind of rational response in my brain that why are these people so, you know, fixated on sex, you know, I talk about this in my book. When I was 16, I worked for a fast food restaurant. It was like my second job, and I was only there for a few months, but I had an openly gay boss, and the bullying, me and another guy got together and decided that we wanted what we considered to be job security. So we decided that we were going to accuse our boss at some point in time when the time was right of hitting on us or flirting with us or doing something sexually overt. And then we were going to hold that over his head because we were, you know, underage Christian teenage boys, you know, working at this. I know.
Did you do it?
Yeah, we did it. I wrote about it, like I said, at the cross of the closet. But and the horrible thing about it, the thing that I remember the most, my behavior was deplorable. I don't know why I ever thought that I was being funny or that I thought I was doing the right thing, but it was just I just took it to an extreme. Well, we did, and we abused him and bullied him mercilessly. And, I mean, I remember one time during a dinner rush. I had some problem on the register. I needed him to come help me. So I paged him over the loudspeaker and said, paging the faggot, paging the faggot.
Oh, my God.
And 6 months after I left that job, he was a... No, he didn't, because he was so afraid that we were going to get him in trouble and he was going to lose his job. And 6 months after I left that job, my coworker came in and told me that Dwayne was a smoker and other than that in good health, that he had had a massive heart attack at work and had died at work.
Oh, my God.
And so, yes. So, yeah, I look at my life and I look back and I feel as though I'm implicit in bullying somebody and causing so much emotional stress in somebody's life that it added to, you know, a cause of death. And I have to live with that. I think it's a combination of a lot of things. I think a lot of it had to do with immature. And, you know, I was, like I said, I was taught this, that my church wouldn't have condoned what I was doing, because as theologically conservative as they were, what I was doing was way crossing. But I think it's a combination, and it has to do with somebody's personal insecurities, and who they target is kind of representative of what they're struggling with in their own lives. And the thing
about your sexuality?
Oh, no, I've never doubted, you know, being straight, but the thing is, I just feel like I was in a mindset where I literally did feel like I was better than everybody else that believed anything differently from me. And, you know, the reason why I'm so open about talking about it now is because this is, you know, my act of penance. You know, I have to be forthright and open about it, and I can't, you know, sit back and try to make it look less bad than it was,
I appreciate that.
You know, yeah. Well, I don't want other people to do the same thing. You know, like we live in a world where that really is cruel at times, and people need to get, you know, put themselves in check. And thank God, you know, I was put in check. So. Yeah, I was going to a dive bar for karaoke every Tuesday night that my friend had introduced me to, which going to a bar in the first place was very uncharacteristic of me. But this dive bar and this karaoke night was so different from anything I had experienced. It was basically church outside of church. These people were so loving and so kind, and it really threw me for a loop. But she wasn't a really super good friend. I had just seen her over the course of about 2 months at karaoke, and I thought she was very cute and she was very fun to be around. But she pulled me outside one day or one night and said, "How can you be a Christian?" And before I could answer, she said, "I just came out to my family, and my dad said that he wasn't going to support and pay for the education of a faggot daughter. Her mom said, 'Come back when you're fixed.'" And they completely excommunicated her from her life. And so she had to drop out of college and move out of state to live with the one friend that she had that wasn't under her parents' thumb. And while she's telling me this, she breaks down crying, and she's in my arms and crying on my shoulder. And instead of listening to her and being there for her and doing what I now know, you know, she wanted me to have done, I was sitting there thinking about how much of a shame it was that her parents were too dumb to explain to her that she was an abomination without making her feel like an abomination.
That was the
literal thought that went through my head. You know, it was, oh man, I could have explained this better. And thank God I didn't get the chance to say anything before she left. I haven't seen her since. When she left, it was this light bulb moment, this epiphany moment for me, that voice inside my head telling me those things and telling me to try to convert her and telling her to try to change her was not God, that was this Pharisee inside me, this programming, this religious programming from 2 decades in the in the conservative church that I was a part of.
Okay, Tim,
and,
I want you to hold that thought. I'm going to get your 50 in just one second.
No, it hit me really instantaneously that how I had acted wasn't the way I was supposed to act. And I realized at that point that I had always used my faith and my theology as a weapon and not as a tool to help other people. And, you know, exactly. And so the thing is, you know, the cops, when they're training to become police officers, they have to, you know, be tased by their own taser and sprayed by their own mace to understand the seriousness of those weapons. And I realized that I had never had the weapon of the Bible or my theology turned back around on me. I had no idea how it felt to be attacked in such a way. And I knew that I needed, in order to question those things, I needed to feel that. And I also knew, you know, simultaneously that how my friend wasn't this scary, you know, agenda-driven lesbian. You know, she was sweet and kind and fun to be around, and I genuinely enjoyed her company when I was around her. And I started wondering how much of what I had been taught about LGBT folks was accurate, or how much of it was stereotypes. I say epiphany or light bulb moment. You know, as a person of faith, I truly believe it was a moment where I had some kind of divine clarity, and God was speaking these things into my life to adjust my course. So I decided. The thought occurred to my head. You know, it popped in my head that the only possible way for me to radically test what I had been taught was to put myself in the shoes of the people that I had been mistreating all my life, and to see how the label of gay would impact my life. And you know, I had no idea. You know, it wasn't like, oh, I'm going to write a book. That didn't come till months and months later. But I just had this deep desire and drive that I needed to understand that fear, that tangible fear that my friend felt when she was coming out, and how that label would change my external life. Obviously, I would never be able to understand what it's like to be gay because I'm straight. But what I could experience as a straight person was how the label of gay would change everybody's perspective of me. And so I made the decision that I was going to come out of the closet as gay, you know, in quotes, to my friends, family, and church. And I was going to live with the label of gay and see how they would, if they would treat me differently, how, what I would lose, whose friendships I would keep, and what would really happen to me because of a label. And, you know, for me, it was this desire to have an empathy rather than a sympathy for my friend.
Now that's a strong move. I mean, that's a major change in your life.
Oh, it's huge.
Did you have second thoughts about it?
Well, I mean, I was scared about it, yeah. I mean, I was terrified going into it. It was 6 months later that I actually did follow through and did it. But I was terrified. And it, you know, it ended up being the best thing I've ever done in my life. You know, and one of the two decisions that I've made in my life that I'm the most sure was the right thing for me to do.
So what did you do?
The first people I came out to were my brother and sister-in-law, and that was January 1st of 2009. And then that day I spent January 1st talking to my family and coming out to my family. I spent January 2nd coming out to my friends, and January 3rd I posted it all on Facebook, changed my orientation and who I was interested in, and so my broader social network. And I was part of the Liberty University network because I went to college for a year at Liberty University, and you know, just so everybody else would be able to see it as well. Here's the thing. I expected a lot more direct confrontational reactions from people. The thing that shocked me the most was that most of the reactions that I got were no reactions at all.
Yeah, the
people
to
who I was friends
with.
Yeah, nobody, like, I instantly lost, I would say, about 95% of my life, of my social life, my friends.
Sure.
And I had a few friends that got together and talked about me and decided that they couldn't condone my poor decision to be gay. But if I chose to ever repent in the future, they would accept me back with open arms. Well, the silence was deafening. You know, I mean, Dr. King said in the end, it's not the words of our enemies will remember, but the silence of our friends. And, you know, and like I said, the silence was deafening. And that was the first major crushing blow for me, was the fact that I had this social life. I'm a very extroverted, gregarious person, and I thrive on being around and interacting with other people. And all of a sudden, boom, I was just this pariah. I had nobody was calling me or texting me or wanting to get together for coffee or anything.
So
I was
going down.
Well, you know, my family, and I think this is typical of a lot of families coming from religious backgrounds. My family acted very lovingly to me, but they were held captive to the same mindset that I was, and they didn't know how to process having a gay brother or a gay son. You know, they did the best they could, and thankfully, you know, they treated me with respect. There were a few instances where we would get into an argument, and they would, you know, say something controversial or slam me for the decisions, quote unquote, that I was making in my life and stuff like that. But by and large, they were very supportive, and they didn't drill me with questions when I came out and told them I was gay. You know, they didn't say, "Oh, well, how long have you known?" and "Have you ever been with a guy?" and yada, yada, yada. They just let it kind of sit and rest for a while there. So I was much luckier than a lot of my LGBT friends who came out of the closet and were, you know, kicked out of their homes or had horrible reactions from their families.
Did you go back to this equation?
No, she moved. And, you know, like, I knew her at karaoke, and that was it. I didn't know her last name. I wasn't friends with her on Facebook or anything like that. So I have no idea where she is or anything. I've been, you know, I've talked to everybody I could think of that would have met her and known her, and nobody's been able to track her down. Okay. So that's, you know, I would love to sit down with her, though.
Did you talk to a preacher or any member of the clergy of your evangelical community about?
Well, yeah, I was working at a church up until about 2 months before I came out. And, took a leave of absence, basically said, "I'm not going to be around. I need to work through some things." And then I emailed my pastor when I came out, and I got a response back from him saying that I could come worship with all the other sinners in the church, but I couldn't serve, and that he didn't condone my choice and said, "Yes, it's a choice. It's not a gene, and you've been hanging around the wrong crowd," and all the typical stuff. He rebuked me in the name of Jesus. And then I looked down at the bottom of the email, and it says, "Sent from AT&T BlackBerry." And I was like, "Oh, wow." So he's probably like sitting in the Starbucks or something, writing this email, rebuking me in the name of Jesus. But, you know, so, and he said, "Oh, but I respect if you want to go to another church, because you probably want to keep this pretty quiet." And I wrote back, and I was like, "Well, no, obviously I've come out. So, you know, I'm not trying to keep this anonymous."
Now, of course, let me ask you this. You also came to meet the gay community. I mean, you came to meet... So what surprised you, if anything, about the gay community?
Oh, man, there aren't enough hours in your show to be able to talk about that. We're taught all these stereotypes in church, and it was eye-opening for me to see that those stereotypes, just how quickly they started falling and how quickly they were proven false. I met so many transparent, amazing, beautiful people. Now, the thing is, with any community, you got your good people and your bad people and your everyday suburban families, and then your single socialites, and to say gay community is, you know, a misnomer. That's like saying straight community, because, you know, that would encompass evangelicals, the KKK,
right.
You know, but, so I know that, but,
well,
but no, I mean, I
expect to see everyone sort of,
oh, absolutely. Well, the first thing I did was, you know, because I had been taught this, I went to a gay dance club. That was the first thing I did. And I had this guy that wasn't wearing a shirt, was covered in baby oil and glitter, pull me out of the dance floor and basically dry hump me to Beyonce. And it terrified me. At which point I realized that I was jumping in to something that was just an alien, you know, kind of an alien existence, alien world, or I was the alien rather, and I needed to. Well, yeah, absolutely, but dancing, as I said before, dancing was something. If I had been in Dirty Dancing, I would have been the dad that didn't want his kid to dance, you know, because I wasn't allowed to. But. Absolutely, it would have been different. And, you know, the thing is, you know, Bonhoeffer is one of my favorite theologians, and he talks about, you know, there are a lot of people, Christians, who dismiss what I say because lying is wrong, period. In the story, there's no justification for what you did. Well, you know, Bonhoeffer asked if hiding Jews during, you know, World War II in Nazi-occupied, you know, Germany and Poland and all these different places, if it was wrong for people to hide Jews so that they wouldn't be taken to the death camps.
Right.
And he said, there's a greater truth that we serve, and serving that truth is what's really ultimately important. You know,
I want to ask it. I got